morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, we'll get an update about the discovery of long-forgotten African-American grave sites, especially one in East Tampa. And later, we'll discuss the legacy of talk show host Rush Limbaugh. But first, three listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we touched on the topics of Limbaugh's death and the causes of Texas's energy crisis. Here's three listener comments that came in after yesterday's program.
Susan from Lakeland, and about Rush Limbaugh, I saw a documentary about him that Frontline did back in 1995, and in it he tells everybody about his plans to become, well, he was just going with the flow. Rush doesn't believe what he says, and it's just enlightening. So all you need to do is go to YouTube and put in Frontline Rush Limbaugh, and it'll come right up.
Hi. At the root of the sickness, capitalism sickness, is the disease of addiction. It's basically, the problem basically is the exploitation of individuals' addictions to profit.
Hi, this is Ernie from Port Richey. After a little research, I discovered that Texans pay an average of 11.86 cents per kilowatt hour. That's below the national average of 13.19. But this year I pay 11.045 cents per kilowatt hour with Withlacoochee River Electric Cooperative. To me, this calls into question the privatization of Texas electricity. Competition was supposed to lower rates, but a cooperative here in Florida has done better.
Those are some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. In recent years, at least eight previously forgotten graves of African Americans have been rediscovered in both Hillsborough and Pinellas County. Most of the graves date back to the late 1800s and early 1900s. How to honor the legacy of the people buried there is now being discussed by the property owners where the grave sites are located. One of the sites is on property partly owned by the Tampa Housing Authority in Robles Park in East Tampa. And joining us now is Leroy Moore, the Chief Operating Officer at the Tampa Housing Authority. And Leroy, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Rob. It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for coming on. Recently, a grave site was discovered that is partly on the Robles site, housing project site, just off North Florida Avenue in East Tampa. And you've got a dilemma what to do about the site. What's the current status of that site?
Yes, and thank you. And you're accurate. A little over a year ago, actually about a year and a half ago now, thanks to the great journalistic work from a Times reporter, Paul Guzzo, who did some research and actually showed that Zion Cemetery, which is believed to be Tampa's first segregation area black cemetery, was under portions of Robles Park Village. And you know, we immediately, wanted to prove up the fact or disprove it. So we engaged with professionals to, one, do the historical research and found that, indeed, that was once Zion. Then we wanted to go a step further and actually confirm if, indeed, everything was removed. So we authorized both ground-penetrating radar and then subsequent to that, what's called ground truthing, where you actually remove layer and layer and layer of soil until you get down to the top of what you've identified through the ground-penetrating radar as anomalies, meaning undisturbed or soil disturbances beneath the surface. And with that confirmations over the last 16 months now, we have indeed proved that the graves are still there. The vast majority of the graves are indeed still there, intact, undisturbed, in the coffins, numbering in the hundreds. So we have actually physically confirmed north of 300 on the land that we own. Public records show that maybe as many as 800 was originally interred there. And there's a lot of the land that we have not yet radared or scanned because it's under the slabs of buildings, or it's under asphalt, or it's under privately owned buildings. That's part of this 2.5-acre Zion Cemetery site.
Mm. If you find out that some of the slabs that contain the housing for people in Robles Park sit above the graves of these people, what are your plans?
Well, we believe that to be the case already. And when we first identified that indeed it was the site, and before we actually got confirming evidence of the ground-penetrating radar, just knowing that it's a historical site, that was Tampa's first black cemetery, segregation-era cemetery, made it, in our minds, a historical site, a site that should be preserved and was historical for us. So we immediately authorized the relocation of those families that was living in buildings that encroached that 2.5-acre cemetery. And Robles Park Village, all total, is 35 acres. It's 85 buildings, apartment buildings, and of the portion that rests on top of the cemetery amount to 5 of the 85 buildings, and approximately 1.5 acre of the 35-acre site. So it was only limited to those 5 buildings. That was 32 families that was occupying those units. We met with the families, told them what we knew at the time, told them what the discoveries to come could reveal, and we worked with all of them to get them relocated to other properties that we own in a matter of, I think, about 90 days or so. So all those families were removed. That site was fenced off, and it has been the site that we have been, you know, furthering the investigation and proving that indeed the bodies are still there. The next phase in this, obviously, is going to be the careful removal of those improvements, the buildings themselves, so that we can actually restore that site to a more dignified resting place for the people that are there.
And that's the intention, to really restore the cemetery to honor the folks who were forgotten for so long and then restore it as a cemetery.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, it's our goal to do as much research as we can to find out who's there, their lives, so that we can piece back the story. You know, it's important that people today are able to know where their loved ones were laid to rest, know where their heritage led from. These were people at the turn of, you know, the century, the last century, who helped build this community. These were business owners. These were you know, hardworking individuals who could afford formal graves. So this was not a potter's field. This was not the indigent place for burials. These were people who bought the plots and actually had official burials. And there's great records, thanks to, you know, both the reporting as well as other people that have pulled together. USF has worked incredibly well with Cardinal, who's our archaeologist company, to piece together this story. And as we redevelop Robles Park Village, which is the remaining portion of this community, we want to also preserve this cemetery, restore it to a place that is you know, dignified and represents the families that was laid to rest there, and also educate future generations on the travesty that took place here. You know, how could a cemetery, you know, be built upon more than once? You know, if you know, warehouses was built on this cemetery dating back to 1921. And then the public housing came in the mid-1950s. So, you know, we just think it's part of the history. It needs to be told accurately and truthfully, and we need to deal with it going forward so that this kind of thing can never again happen.
Our guest is Leroy Moore, the Chief Operating Officer at the Tampa Housing Authority, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Are there any plans to move everybody who's now living at Robles Park out of that area, or will that housing complex remain?
Yes, it is actually under master planning as we speak. All the family members have been notified. They've been actively involved in our planning process, which is a very community-engaging process. It's been taking place now for the last year and a half, and more specifically for the master plan for the last 4 or 5 months. In the next 2 months, we will be publishing a master plan that actually shows what this 35-acre site will become. We will hopefully start the relocation of some of the families. We may do a phased relocation, unlike our past redevelopments, but that's yet to be determined. We will consult more with our families to find out their best wishes. But the intent is toward the end of this year to start relocations. And probably toward the end of 2022 to start demolition of the remaining portion of Robles Park Village. So you'll see a 2023 and 5 years out from there development taking place on that site.
And what happens to the land? I mean, you know, obviously there's been a lot of investment in the last few years in places like Tampa Heights and Seminole Heights, Southeast Seminole Heights. And, you know, there's people are moving back into the area, too. I mean, obviously, there have been longtime residents there, but now new people are moving in. The sure. land has become more valuable than it was maybe 25 years ago.
Right. Well, for us, obviously, we're the Tampa Housing Authority. So, you know, our you know, primary concern is the advancement and availability and expansion of our affordable housing portfolio. We have 433 units at Robles Park that will eventually be demolished, hopefully starting late next year. And we, our plan, when we reveal the master plan in the coming 60 days, I think is going to show anywhere from 900 to maybe 1,100 new units coming back to that site. Now, all those units will not be affordable housing, but it will be a mix of both affordable workforce and market rate housing, because as we redevelop these communities, we want never to redevelop, you know, for one socioeconomic group, but we want to redevelop a very diverse community, both with people as well as with uses. So we think this 35-acre site, after you remove the Zion piece, will lend itself to north of 1,000 units, of which at least 650 or more will be replacement units plus expanded affordable housing, and then another 300 to 400 units of workforce and market rate housing. But in addition to that, community facilities, parks, and facility buildings that allow us to provide services direct to this population, hopefully even a grocery store in this particular neighborhood. So we want to build back with neighborhood amenities that support more holistic and sustainable development. One thing is jobs. When we build a grocery store, when we build office buildings, when we build retail, we're also building long-term permanent jobs. Now you have people who live on site who have the ability, hopefully, to get local jobs on site. And what does that do? That cuts back on their transportation costs, which is typically a real big part of a person's ability to live affordably. We control their rent at 30% of area median income, and our residents pay no greater than 30% of their income toward their rent. But they could pay 30 or 40 or more percent of their income earned on transportation costs. Take example, if they live in affordable housing in Brandon to get to their job in Tampa. So, you know, the idea here is to build in a more sustainable community that allows people to recreate, live, work, play in close proximity in an urban community, thereby increasing their affordability and providing services closer to them so that they don't have to commute as far.
Well, our guest is Leroy Moore, who is the Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Tampa Housing Authority. He's been leading what's been called Candid Conversations. His conversation is about the Zion Cemetery, Robles Park. The conversations are sponsored in part by the Urban Land Institute, which is in the midst of a 21-day equitable development challenge. They've been discussing issues of social inequality and racism and talking about the real estate industry especially. So, Leroy, one other question. One of the big ways to generate wealth and transfer it from generation to generation is to own real estate, is to own a house. What ideas do you have to try to encourage people who are in the low income spectrum to find ways to buy property, buy a house?
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you also for pointing out the 21-Day Equitable Development Challenge that's sponsored by ULI. And, you know, we're trying to get as many people in the community to, if you just Google ULI Tampa Bay, you go to that website, you can actually join the 21-Day Equitable Development Challenge, learn a lot about our local community here, and also about how we got to where we are today, where, you know, too many of our communities are segregated. Too many of our black and brown citizens have been left out of the American dream of being able to build wealth. And one of the, best ways to build family wealth, as you mentioned, is in the field of home ownership, and how both government policy as well as private prejudices work together. In the early 1900s, right up until the 1970s, to create these kind of disparities that we still have today, where we live in segregated communities and segregated manners, and the home ownership rate in the black community is a fraction of what it is in the white community. And one of the ways that we try to combat that at Tampa Housing Authority, obviously, is by encouraging home ownership. We actually sponsor home ownership opportunities with our Section 8 vouchers. The Section 8 voucher can actually be used to help pay the mortgage, not just rent on an apartment. So we have 100 or so families that are using that Section 8 voucher to own their home. We also partner with a number of agencies that provide first-time home buyer education. We sponsor any of our residents that want to become homeowners through that process. We pay the cost of the tuition for them to get certified as a first-time home buyer trained, and then we assist them with finding the right mortgage that suits their own needs. At Robles Park, as we redevelop Robles, there will be homeownership opportunities there as well, and many of those homeownership opportunities will be set aside for people earning below 80% of area median income, which are the criteria for public housing and Section 8 resident eligibility. So trying to get more of our families to actually make that transition when they are ready, but also making sure that the education and the system is in place there so that it is a successful transition from renter to owner. There's a totally different mindset. There's a totally different approach to maturity and sustainability when you move into the home ownership side. So we don't want families to move into those opportunities prematurely, because it could result in failure. So we provide that training and encourage them to be ready. So we have, I think, something like 700 families that are participating now in our family self-sufficiency program, which actually allows them to build a nest egg while they are paying rent, so that when they are ready for that home ownership move, they now already have the down payment saved up. And it's actually just taking a portion of the rent that they're already paying and putting it in an interest-bearing account on their behalf. And when they graduate from that program, they have that money. We've had families graduating with $30,000, $40,000, and $45,000 balances in their escrow from the rent that they was paying to us in public housing.
Wow!
So it's a big aid and step toward homeownership.
Yeah, I had no idea that Section 8 could be used to buy a private home. So if people are just hearing about this for the first time, how can they find out more?
Yes, email me is the best way. My email is leroy.more, leroy.more, @thafl.com, and I will put them in touch with our department that can point them in the right direction.
Well, Leroy Moore, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. It's great to have you here.
My pleasure, always. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Leroy Moore is the Senior Vice President of the Tampa Housing Authority, and we've been talking about the candid conversations that he holds, discussing the Zion Cemetery and the Robles Park and the future development in that area. And in part, this effort is sponsored by the Tampa Bay chapter of the Urban Land Institute, which has launched a 21-day equitable development challenge. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about the legacy of Rush Limbaugh that's coming up in the next part of the program. Music from Oliver Mitikudzi here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh died earlier this week at the age of 70. For three decades, his afternoon show dished out his conservative opinions. It had a big impact on the country. Without Limbaugh, it's difficult to imagine the entire conservative media structure that we know today. Fox News, Tucker Carlson, Bill O'Reilly, OAN, Breitbart, and perhaps even the presidency of Donald Trump. The radio host's death prompted Trump to return to Fox News this week for an interview, and on the Fox News website, Limbaugh was memorialized as the greatest of all time. But to critics who saw Limbaugh as a spreader of bigotry, it was good riddance. He coarsened the dialogue on radio by especially attacking those less powerful, African Americans, women, the disabled, and those fighting for a better environment. At least one Florida politician right now is calling for state flags here in Florida to be flown at half-mast to honor Rush Limbaugh. Jeff Cohen founded Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the New York-based Media Watch Group, way back in 1986. He was the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he was an associate professor of journalism, and he joins us live right now. Jeff Cohen, welcome back to WMNF.
Great to be with you.
So tell me what you think the legacy of Rush Limbaugh is.
Well, I had a personal relationship in the sense that I co-wrote a book about him. I wrote these reports that people can find at FAIR's website, FAIR.org. I did lectures about Limbaugh. My four-year-old daughter said, "Daddy, you must love Rush Limbaugh. You watch him every night." That was painful. Limbaugh had a TV show for a couple years. I would say that everything you said in the intro is totally true. He really was a pioneer. He did help lay the foundation for the right-wing media power that we have today. He was a pseudo-populist, pretended to be with the working class, and when actually he was born into wealth. His family were corporate lawyers, part of the Republican structure. He once joked that one of his relatives wasn't a lawyer. He was a banker. So he had this pseudo-populism. Donald Trump continued it in the more modern era. He pioneered in climate change denial. Trump was an original birther, trying to argue that Obama was an illegitimate president because he wasn't born in the U.S. He was doing that before Trump got involved in birtherism. But I think you nailed it, that the key, there's no doubt, I listened to Limbaugh day after day. I was doing it even a few weeks ago. There's no doubt he was a talented communicator and very articulate. But you nailed it when you said he punched downward. some of the great satirists and comedians in U.S. history could be very biting, but they generally punched upward against people who were wealthy, people who were in power, people who were celebrities. Limbaugh liked to make fun of homeless people. He did segment after segment making fun of gay men that were dying of AIDS. So it's that punching downward that I found so offensive.
Mm. You mentioned that he was a supporter of birtherism just recently, just a few weeks ago, while he was still doing his show. He said that Joe Biden did not win the election. This was after the January 6th mob stormed the Capitol. And so he even took part in that conspiracy theory, that falsehood.
Well, and it again, he was the beginning of what Trump finalized, which was to convince millions of people, don't listen to journalism, don't listen to public radio news. That's all lies. Just listen to me. I'm the only one telling you the truth. So that Limbaugh, to the people that are in his audience, and he had millions to the very end, they didn't have any alternative information, any factual information about who really won. I mean, Biden won in Georgia, Biden won in Arizona, Biden won in Wisconsin. There's no doubt about it. But if you get your news from Trump's Twitter feed today, or, you know, a few months ago, or Limbaugh's radio show up until a few weeks ago, you just get these conspiracy theories, and they just there's no factual information. It was something that Limbaugh was very good at achieving, and Trump finalized. Don't trust journalism. Trust only me.
I'm going to go through a list of some of the things he said, and I think that even Rush's fans would admit that all this is true because they know it. They listen, they heard it. But he was airing that song, the racist parody of Senator Barack Obama, then Senator Barack Obama, Barack the Magic Negro. He said his quote was, "Feminism was established to allow unattractive women access to the mainstream of society." In 2004, he called the National Basketball Association, he called it the Thug Basketball Association, and he said the team should stop be calling, should not be called teams, that they should be called gangs. When he was young, Limbaugh told a black caller, take that bone out of your nose and then call me back. Recently, he called a Georgetown law student, Sandra Fluke, a slut and a prostitute, after she publicly advocated for universal contraception coverage. So this is what he did day in and day out, yet advertisers, for the most part, stuck with him. Why is that?
Well, he's profitable. It wasn't just advertisers. Everything you read, there's no Limbaugh ditto head, a follower of Limbaugh who would object. They know that he said all these things. And the amazing thing isn't just advertisers, it's the way the corporate centrist media treated Limbaugh. In the year 2000, ABC, owned by Disney, attested, they auditioned Limbaugh to be the color commentator on ABC Monday Night Football. You know, that's a sport that's 70% African American.
There was a headline. I'll just briefly say this. There was a headline that says, Rush to join MNF. Now, MNF is the name of our radio station. So I clipped that headline from the newspaper. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But I mean, at the time when Disney, after this litany of racist comments about black people, that ABC was considering adding him as a ratings device to be a color commentator, I'm proud to say that when I was at Fair and Disney was considering hiring Limbaugh for ABC Monday Night Football, we got a column published with a number of his racist comments, and the headline was "A Color Man Who Has a Problem with Color," and I think that column did damage Limbaugh. And ABC went in a different direction. But, you know, Ted Koppel of Nightline, he once had Limbaugh, who knows nothing about the environment, in a debate with then-Senator Al Gore. Limbaugh appeared on Meet the Press, and Tim Russert praised him, then the host of Meet the Press, for getting his facts straight. Charlie Rose had him on public TV. So when I mean, I had to immerse myself in Limbaugh in order to write a book about it. And I would hear people say, yeah, but you have to admit he's kind of funny. He does have a good sense of humor, people would want me to admit. And I said, I can't listen to it for more than 10 or 15 minutes without being so irritated by the punching downward and the racial bias and the making fun of women. I can't get beyond that to enjoy anything that might be called humor. And the fact that these people in the mainstream media, whether it's Disney or Ted Koppel at ABC or Charlie Rose or Meet the Press, the fact that they, again, he was a ratings bonanza for any show he went on, because he would promote it for days. I'm going to be on Meet the Press. I'm going to be on Meet the Press. And it's sickening. It shows the corporate nature, the profiteering nature of mainstream centrist media that they wanted Limbaugh on their shows.
Tell me about the Fairness Doctrine and its withdrawal under Ronald Reagan and how that impacted the growth of conservative shows like Rush Limbaugh's.
It was a direct factor. During the Reagan administration, the FCC ended the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was very rarely enforced, but it was a simple FCC doctrine that said if you have a radio or a TV broadcast station, you have to deal with issues of concern, topical issues, and deal with them by showing different points of view. And the Fairness Doctrine, when it was ended by Reagan's FCC in the 1980s, this is a fact that most people don't know. Republicans and Democrats in the Congress united, and they tried to overrun the veto. They tried to restore the Fairness Doctrine. Reagan vetoed that bill, and they couldn't override it. So on both sides of the aisle, people wanted to keep the Fairness Doctrine, but the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated. It led directly to right-wing talk radio being able to put one right-wing voice hour after hour after hour, 24/7, without any concern that listeners can no longer use the Fairness Doctrine to complain to the Federal Communications Commission. There were other factors. The 800 number was invented, where toll-free calling from around the country. And Limbaugh is the guy. Talk radio used to be local. Political talk radio is just a local phenomenon until Limbaugh went national in 1988 with the aid of 1-800 numbers, making it possible for a national audience to call in. And, you know, I've been a media critic for decades, and I've always heard this, what I consider BS, from apologists for our corporate-dominated media system, which is anyone who's popular, the corporate owners of the media, they don't care. They'll put on anyone who's got a big audience. They just don't care. Well, the reality is that talk radio, political talk, started in the late 60s and early 70s, and it was local. And even in liberal cities, the people that owned radio stations were using talk radio. They gave the microphone to all these right-wingers who would attack feminism, attack civil rights, attack hippies and the counterculture. Talk radio was always right-wing, even in liberal cities. I grew up in Detroit, and it was right-wing. I moved to Los Angeles, a very liberal city, and they had one right-wing host after another, local talk show host, Ray Bream, Joe Pine, and others.
This is even under the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine is there. Yeah.
But they didn't go 24/7 right-wing. They would often balance it with talk, or balance it with news. You know what I mean? It wasn't before Fairness Doctrine was abolished. There was at least some balance, you know, political talk show with a business talk show or a parenting talk show. It was after the Fairness Doctrine where you could go 24/7 just right-wing political talk.
Is there any evidence that conservatives or people that are interested in spreading conservative philosophies subsidize these broadcast shows in any way?
Yes, I've seen that in the context of Limbaugh. I saw it in the context, I mean, the Hunts used to be, the Hunt, you know, oil people used to be big in radio ownership. a lot of the companies that owned radio stations were right-wing. Obviously, the one that's most known is more modern than Limbaugh, but it helped Limbaugh, was Clear Channel, which is now known as iHeartMedia or iHeartRadio. And they owned hundreds and hundreds of channels of radio stations. And they, for a while, they had some liberal hosts and they had Air America. But, you know, the owners of media and owners of radio stations have always tilted to the right-wing point of view. And there has been evidence of subsidy in terms of getting money to right-wing voices by buying up huge numbers of their books. Limbaugh didn't have that problem with his big audience. He could become a bestseller. But, yeah, there's been evidence all along of people like the Coors family, the Hunt family, pushing right-wing points of view to the top.
Our guest is Jeff Cohen, and he's the co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He was a professor at Ithaca College at the Park Center for Independent Media, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Jeff, you want to take some phone calls?
Sure.
All right, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Just before we go to the phones, what direction do you think Fox News is going to take? They've taken out what they called their one of their news people at 7 o'clock in the evening and put on an opinion show. I don't know if you would consider the previous host a news person, but what direction do you think Fox News is going?
They've gone more right wing. There's no doubt about it. Trump was upset that they had called Arizona very early for Biden. Biden ended up winning Arizona. It was too early of a call, that's for sure. But Biden won Arizona. And, you know, Trump has often complained about Fox News polls. And so a lot of the audience was going to even more right-wing TV channels, especially Newsmax and One America News. And so there's no doubt that there have been some moves in the last couple months with Fox News trying to go a little bit further right-wing so as not to lose more viewers to Newsmax and One America News. And if you watch Newsmax, they make fun of Fox. You know, they say the Fox is on the run is one of their promos.
Because it's not far right enough?
Yes. Yes, that Newsmax is more pro-Trumpian, One America News, Trump, 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 Trump can do no wrong. Whereas Fox News occasionally had a journalist on saying, you know, the president is wrong on this, or the facts don't bear out on this. You know, so Fox News, as pro-Trump as it was not pro-Trumpian enough for some viewers, and they went over to Newsmax and One America News.
Let's go to our first caller. Jose in Tarpon Springs is calling in. Jose, you're on with Jeff Cohen. What's your question?
Well, actually, I didn't have a question. I figured you guys would be stopping soon, and we'd just make our comments about Rush Limbaugh. I grew up hating the guy, of course, because his racism, I can see now where they're showing videos of him making fun of Michael J. Fox with Parkinson's disease, and I don't think they show enough of that. I find it ironic, though, or wonderfully ironic, and there's no love lost here. I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, it's a shame he died. Actually, I can't say that. But in 2015, I believe he was actually telling his viewers that not only was there, it was not true that smoking could kill you, but he was claiming that secondhand smoke was a myth, that smoking cigarettes was a myth, that he said that that was all a big lie and everything. And the fact that he died of lung cancer, he was a smoker, I find it sweetly ironic. But that's really all I have to say.
Yeah, Jose, the point that Jose brought up about making fun of Michael J. Fox and ridiculing the idea that nicotine, cigarettes, tobacco causes cancer, it's not debatable. That's what Limbaugh stood for. We have all of these myths in a book we put out called The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error, back in 1995. But I think part of the legacy of Limbaugh, Jose was hitting on, which is the meanness. you know, and Trump became the mean president. There's never been a president before that was an insult comic like Donald Trump. But I think it began years earlier with Limbaugh, where there was this idea that, you know, liberals and progressives, they didn't just have the wrong policy. They were evil. They were satanic. I mean, it's reached its apex now with the QAnon conspiracy. But Limbaugh, there was this effort to demonize. He talked about how Hillary Clinton's apartment, it was linked to Vince Foster's killing. Vince Foster was a Clinton administration aide that committed suicide, and Limbaugh was trying to link the murder, you know, make it a murder and link it to Hillary Clinton. The most amazing thing, we put it in our book, and I was watching this on his television show. He said, he makes a joke. He said, you know, the Clintons in the White House, everyone knows they have a family cat. Did you know also that they have a family dog? And they put, and Limbaugh puts up a picture of Chelsea Clinton, the daughter, who's age 13.
Yeah. I mean,
that kind of viciousness in the guise of humor, I think Trump then took decades later with Limbaugh's audience to a much bigger, worse height.
All right. Jose, thanks a lot. Jeff, you know, I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s and reading National Review because I was on the debate team, so we had to read left and right wing publications. And I would read like William Rusher, William Sapphire, William F. Buckley, all the Williams. But they didn't resort to personal attacks. They made their point through facts and philosophical arguments, but that wasn't... I mean, I remember the conservative movement going back to the early 70s. They didn't have to resort to name-calling.
They didn't want to resort to name-calling. You know, I was a media figure. I was on Fox News when it began, but you go decades before that, and right-wingers, the ones you named especially, Buckley, Rusher, they wanted to debate policy. But again, Limbaugh turned it into sort of a blood sport. And if you were a white male who didn't quite care too much for feminism or equal rights for minorities, then that's kind of biting humor, and that kind of attack humor welcomed you in. And I think I've heard you talk, Rob, about the movie. There's such a brilliant movie, a documentary about how Limbaugh and Fox News sucked so many people in who were not that political, to become voters, and then to become right-wing activists. And that movie is called The Brainwashing of My Dad, directed by Jen Sanko. And it's really a fascinating documentary about the impact of right-wing media in our country and how it grew from Limbaugh all the way to today.
Yeah, we still get requests from people to play that soundtrack. I think we did a few weeks ago. Jeff Cohen is our guest. He's the co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. Let's go to Michelle in Tampa for the next question. Hi, Michelle. You're on with Jeff Cohen. Hi, Michelle. Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good now.
Okay. I had one comment about Rush Limbaugh, and then I have a question for Jeff. My only comment about Rush Limbaugh was when I heard he had passed away at the age of 70 from lung cancer, it restored my faith in karma. I thought that karma was no longer active when you see all the people get away with the things that they do, but maybe Ted Cruz getting caught, too, is also restoring my faith in karma. But with the viciousness on the networks and on talk radio, I'm asking you two professionals, what can the common people do? What can we do to get companies to stop promoting this?
Jeff?
Well, there have been a number of activist groups. It's not something that FAIR.org does, but a number of activist groups have gone to some of these owners, some of the advertisers, and tried to get the advertisers to flee. That certainly happened after he made his comment on Fluke, the abortion rights activist, and he called her like a slut or a prostitute. And at that point, there was a lot of advertiser flight. But I'm one who believes the way to answer this kind of awful speech is with better speech. And I'm a big proponent, as everyone knows, of independent media, community radio, independent websites, places that actually do journalism. If they attack the right wing, it's over policy, it's not by name calling. So I'm a big believer that the role of media activists should be to help build independent, progressive, and independent journalistic media, do it through social media, do it through donations. You know, the independent journalistic media has never been stronger. Obviously, the internet has given us a problem with right-wing disinformation, hate, and conspiracy mongering. But also, the internet has allowed progressive news and serious journalistic news outlets to grow. Millions of people get their news now from non-corporate sources, whether it's Democracy Now! And Pacifica Radio or The Young Turks on Web TV or websites like TheNation.com, The Intercept, CommonDreams.org, TruthOut.org. My advice to people that are upset about right-wing media is do your part to promote independent media that actually practices journalism. Donate to those outlets. Spread the word. Use social media to spread the word about real journalism. That's the way to counteract the hate.
All right. Michelle, thanks a lot. Thanks for the question.
Thank you.
And you're listening to 88.5 FM. I keep waiting for, Amy Goodman's just celebrated her 25th anniversary on the air this morning. I keep waiting for the next generation of Amy Goodmans to come along.
I think it's happening. I this is what I studied at Ithaca College from 2008 to 2018. And the number of podcasts and web video casts, or vodcasts, including people of color and people under 30, under 35. I mean, when we did our Vote Trump Out, Then Challenge Biden campaign for RootsAction.org, I was surprised at all these new podcasts I'd never even heard of, and I would do like a 15-minute interview with them, and then I would hear, you know, for the next week, the thing reverberating around the internet. So, I mean, I think independent progressive journalism is thriving, but, you know, corporations are putting all of their money and all of their advertising between either the centrism of a CNN or the right-wingism of a Fox News. So the corporate spectrum in media goes from, it's pretty narrow, from General Electric to General Motors, from Biden to Trump. But, you know, half of the country is outside of that corporate political spectrum, and you have to go to independent sources, non-corporate sources, to hear these other ideas.
Are there things that you wish, I mean, you were once affiliated with MSNBC, but yeah. Are there things that you wish that MSNBC would delve into that it doesn't? Are there parameters that MSNBC has set for itself that it won't touch yet?
I mean, again, I know there are a lot of liberals who love MSNBC. I can't stand it. I just find it's not journalism, it's partisanship. They tell you all about Ted Cruz going to Texas. I mean, going to Cancun. But they didn't talk about, you know, they don't talk about the hypocrisies of the corporate Democrats. Nancy Pelosi and the hair salon, when hair salons were restricted in California. That was hour after hour on Fox News. Never mentioned on MSNBC. Now, Ted Cruz is hour after hour on MSNBC and barely mentioned on Fox News. It's partisanship. It's not journalism.
But they have gone after Chris Cuomo. I mean, both CNN and MSNBC.
A little,
not enough. Okay, go ahead.
Again, it should have been done months ago. If you read David Sirota, the great independent journalist, he was exposing Cuomo months ago and nursing homes. So MSNBC will not touch things like net neutrality. Why? Because it's owned by Comcast. And Comcast is trying to end net neutrality, an open internet. So they almost never discuss it on MSNBC. On MSNBC, they won't take on corporate power. They will often talk about the Koch brothers because they fund the right wing. And on Fox News, they'll talk about George Soros because he funds liberals. But on neither Fox News or MSNBC do they talk about what I know I hear on MNF all the time, is what's wrong with the corporate system as a whole? How do corporations have too much power over both political parties? You'll never hear that on MSNBC because they are basically the voice piece of the corporate leadership of the Democratic Party. You know, I'm always told how they're the CNN and MSNBC were the anti-Trump channels, and it's true. They campaigned against Trump for 4 years, and they campaigned for Biden for about a year. They also were the anti-Bernie channels. For months, they were campaigning and smearing Bernie Sanders because they see themselves as sort of allied with the corporate leadership of the Democratic Party. Fox News is allied with the corporate leadership of the Republican Party. That's not a good choice. You should go to independent journalistic sources.
All right. You can tell I don't live in New York State. I call them Chris Cuomo. That's the TV guy. The governor's Andrew.
Right.
Jeff Cohen is here, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Mike in Brandon for the next question. Mike, you're on. What's your question?
Yeah. My question for you is this. Do you think that most of the viewers or the listeners, do you think they understand that they are opinion hosts? Now, you know, I know Rush, he had his tagline, America's Newsman. And I've listened to the show and people call in and basically say, you know, that they'll exclusively get their information from him. But at the end of the day, when they get into trouble with their with what they say, whether it's him or Hannity or Glenn Beck or any of the others, they're opinion hosts.
That's always their defense.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. They go to that. They say, well, it's my opinion, blah, blah, blah. I'm an entertainer. And the other thing is, I don't think most people realize they're pitchmen. Because it's funny. You listen to 1 hour. If you go through the hour, you know when they're going to take their breaks. Like Mark Levine, he'll get all bent out of shape. He'll get himself all worked up. And then next thing you go, brought to you by, you need some gold, or you need this, or you need that. They're basically their salespeople. And so my question to your guest is, does he believe most people realize that that's what they are? They're pitchmen.
Okay. Mike, thanks a lot.
I do not believe their hardcore audience believes that they are merely giving well-founded opinions. I think that they are seriously believed by their audience. And I think Fox News has got a high level of belief from its viewers and Limbaugh and the talk radio. You're right. To me and you, they appear to be just ranters, and their opinions are not based on fact. I've got nothing against opinion journalism. It's just got to be based on fact. The talk show hosts you named do not base their opinions on fact. But no, I don't think that the hardcore audience sees these folks as mere entertainers or you know, pitchmen. I think they're really believed for their political credibility and new and journalistic credibility, if contradiction in terms, I think.
Jeff, we got every line lit, so we probably should have you back to talk more about this.
Sure.
But I only have about 30 or 35 seconds left. Do you think boycotts make sense? I mean, let's say that I'm listening to an advertiser, a local advertiser on a show like Rush Limbaugh, and I call that advertiser's headquarters up and say, look, I don't like you supporting a guy that says the election was stolen. I'm going to not ever shop at your place. Does that work?
It does work. It's something that FAIR has avoided because we believe advertisers have too much influence over the news, period. So by, you know, leaning on them to decide who gets to speak and who doesn't. But yeah, there's no doubt it works. That there's been a lot of deplatforming by huge corporations because they don't want to be associated with what happened on January 6th at the Capitol. There's no doubt that some right-wing outlets are feeling the pinch.
Jeff Cohen, thanks a lot. Where can people read your columns?
JeffCohen.org is where you can find all the columns I've written over the years, and you could even dig up some Limbaugh stuff. I heard a caller on your show at the beginning say they watched the Frontline documentary about Limbaugh. I was one of the experts in that documentary. That's free online.
Another reason to watch it. Jeff Cohen, thanks a lot. We got to get you back. Thank you.
Right, sounds great. Bye-bye, Rob.
That's Jeff Cohen, co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. If you want to comment about today's show, call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back Monday morning. Stay tuned for Janelle. She's in the house. This is WMNF in Tampa. Thank